It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a recent National Labor Relations Board decision could significantly expand bargaining rights for subcontracted employees. We'll talk to a labor reporter.
But first, think back to some of your favorite movies and books over the past handful of years. Chances are films like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou and the Percy Jackson series might be among them.
You're Hades?
Yes.
Oh, sorry, I didn't expect you to look like this, man. Kind of stylish. I like it.
Would you prefer that I looked like this?
Hades and other Greek deities and heroes and other staples of the classical world have been popping up in pop culture over the last decade, and our guest says these books, movies, and TV shows are spurring a revival of interest in the study of the original material, the classics.
Andrew Porter is an assistant professor in the Department of Foreign Language and Literature at UW-Milwaukee. He joins us now to talk about this new interest in those ancient stories. Andrew, welcome to Central Time.
Veronica and Rob, thanks for having me on.
Well, Andrew, it sounds like Hollywood has been a boon for your classes. What are you hearing from students who want to take the classics?
Absolutely. Our classic numbers are a boom themselves, and we actually teach about 1,600 students a year at UWM, which is fantastic if you think there are only 6.5 of us teaching these courses, 6.5 full-time position. But in any case, you know, students really tell you about their interests very clearly if you ask them. That's really the key. Some years ago, 2007, 2008, I began actually surveying students online to find out what they liked or disliked about our courses. And we've since begun doing that in various departments and so on. But what I found from the students themselves, surveying about 2,000 students of my own since 2008, really mythology appeals to me as something I hear again and again and again. I find mythology fascinating, or I was extremely interested in the subject matter. And you know, in Wisconsin schools, students often in grade 12, junior, senior year, in any case, say read the Odyssey. So for them, they've heard this before and they just want to read the Iliad and the Odyssey in full. They want to have discussions about it, and they're very interested in the subject. In fact, one really interesting thing happened with our UWM theater department that shows you that the range of ages interest in the subject of classics is really widespread. Ann Basting, who is in the theater department, asked me to come on board as a humanities expert. Though I always remember what my dad said about experts were a drip under pressure. But in any case, I came on board somewhat reluctantly. But she actually did a wonderful thing. She had the UWM Theater Department collaborating with the residents of the Wisconsin Luther Manor. And it's a very large manor of seniors. She had a theater company come in, I think it was a Sojourn Theater. And they had performances of what they called Finding Penelope, where they actually interwove the stories, the actual stories of these seniors from real life into the magnificent story of Penelope, who waited home in Ithaca for her husband, absent for 20 years, to come home. Mm. And so we heard these real life stories that really were very effective for the audience and for those experiencing them as seniors as well as those involved as students.
And Andrew, I wanted to ask, as you surveyed students, you mentioned just maybe a natural interest, but did they cite pop culture, maybe the Percy Jackson movies or Rome or 300 as a reason that sparked their interest in these topics?
Absolutely. For instance, I always make it a habit, not just because it's my favorite movie, of showing Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And whenever I have a course on ancient epic, the Iliad and the Odyssey in particular, and when I ask the students to put up their hand if they'd seen this movie, and this movie is getting a little dated now, usually 3/4 of the students have watched it, and that, of course, is a movie that's based very intricately, very, very subliminally, and at times very humorously on Homer's Odyssey, which is a terrific story about the return home of Odysseus. But yes, Troy, for instance, or the 300, or the Percy Jackson series are all things that interest students. Believe it or not, some of them can still remember Hercules from more my generation, I think.
We're talking right now with Andrew Porter, assistant professor in the Department of Foreign Languages and Literature at UW-Milwaukee, talking about an uptick in interest in the classics, thanks to pop culture. And, Andrew, can you make the case that these aren't just fascinating, interesting old stories, they're actually useful to students in how they perform in real life?
You know, it's interesting. When you look at the range of movies that began in the 50s, from Ulysses, Helen of Troy, Jason the Argonauts, Medea, Alexander the Great, and so on, you say to yourself, there's an interest out there. Really, I just go back to the students once again. What is it that they like about this? These stories, what do they like about classics? You know, I have a retired engineer, for instance, who wanted to read ancient Greek to gain a sense of the beauty and meaning of poetry. Students in psychology wanted to learn some ancient stories. They'd visited Italy. One anthropology student said to me, I like Greek because it makes me think. A student of Latin said, I like the puzzle of it. A journalist took my one of my courses where you have to write a research paper, and he wasn't even aware before this of where to find the greatest gathering of journal articles that deal with every subject under the sun, JSTOR we call it in academia. But I think it's really true to say it depends upon your premise. What does it mean to be interesting or important for real life? If you feel that we're actually developing the whole person, we're developing creative juices, we're developing interest for people who go to as teachers, librarians, professors, legal experts, archaeologists, people in medicine, religious studies. If creativity interests matter for humans, I think classics is valuable. And I heard your show last evening when I was driving home rather late from the office, and I heard, I think, a former professor from Princeton talk about how the humanities can actually be put into dollars. That is, it does make a difference that companies are looking for the creativity and the expansive knowledge, the ability to adapt, the ability to analyze that humanities bring to a student. All the same, I'd like to suggest that interest isn't something we ought to easily put away. A student comes to a university quite often for a full education as compared with going to, say, a strictly technical college. And so there's opportunity, even for those who don't major in classics, even for the 1,600 students from most of the different disciplines who take our courses, to really meet an interest. And I think if we believe that it's important to fan into flame the human spirit and interest, then I think classics has a place always in our universities and our public's life.
So, Andrew, suppose somebody's listening wants to fan that flame, maybe not quite ready to leap into the Greek or Latin. I'm a little rusty. Well, all right, they never learn them. What's a good place to start? Give us a little quick reading list or even viewing list if you want to get us started.
Absolutely. You know, I may be an accountant, and I want to, begin to read about ancient drama. Well, you know, the first dramas of the Western world began in ancient Greece. Now, I would really strongly suggest the dramas of Euripides. Euripides is really the most psychological of all the dramatists. He really meets our need in today's society. Before the time of developed psychology and psychiatrists, he actually really digs deeply into the human spirit to see what makes people tick. And he deals with really the larger issues in life, things like sibling rivalry. I think of his movie The Trojan Women, where you have two brothers, Eteocles and Polynices. They're brothers. They're supposed to share the rule one year after another in alternating fashion. Their father, Oedipus, who most people have heard about, has died. And one brother, Eteocles, just doesn't want to give up his rule. And he admits it. Power's great, and I don't want to give it up. And their poor mother is caught in the middle of two brothers fighting. In the end, it's such a tragic tale. The two brothers go head-to-head at a parapet and kill one another in the struggle. The Alcestes play, for instance, is a terrific play about loss and shame and regret, where Admetus has the opportunity not to die because of a favor he had done. But the catch is this, and it's a very important one. He has to actually, has to find someone to die for him. Mm. And in the end, it's his wife that takes up the challenge. So themes of shame. The Medea is a wonderful story for couples that are drifting apart and want to justify their actions. It's a terrible tragedy in human life, and children, of course, end up suffering.
Andrew, a great start to our reading list there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're most welcome. Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Veronica.
That's Andrew Porter, assistant professor in the Department of Foreign Languages and Literature at UW-Milwaukee. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, UW campuses across the state are gearing up for the first day of classes this week. We'll talk to a reporter about how they're preparing after a challenging summer of budget cuts and faculty tension.
First, bargaining rights for subcontractor, franchise, and temporary employees could be significantly expanded after a decision by the National Labor Relations Board last week. The decision comes at a time when internet-based companies like Uber and Lyft are increasingly relying on independent contractors who don't have many of the labor protections that standard employees do.
The decision centered around whether or not a company that gets workers from outside contractors is a joint employer of those workers. The board said yes, but the debate is likely not over. Here with us now is Lydia DePillis, Washington Post reporter covering labor and business. Lydia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's start with the term joint employer. What does that mean in this case?
That means that a business has a role in co-determining the conditions of work, basically. So sometimes your work life isn't just determined by the company that signs your checks. Sometimes it's also the company that employs the company that signs your checks, right? So if a subcontractor is working on the site of a general contractor, then, and they have a lot of rules, then that means they impact your day-to-day.
Now, can you do a little stage setting for us now? Tell us about the case that brought this issue in front of the National Labor Relations Board.
Sure. So this is a case that came up in 2013, and the Teamsters out in California were trying to organize a staffing agency called Lead Point, which was working for a recycling company called Browning Ferris. And they didn't just want to bargain with Lead Point because they felt like Browning Ferris actually did a lot of things like supervising their workers, determining the hours of work, determining discipline, effectively setting the price of work, which influences wages, having a role in who is hired and fired. And so they said, look, we want to bargain with Browning Ferris itself as well. And this is a concept that is not unknown in labor. It's certainly used in sometimes in unions and sometimes with other labor laws like that administer benefits. But under a previous standard, the joint employer would have to exert very direct control, not necessarily indirectly through a staffing agency. So a regional director disagreed with the Teamsters, but the board just last week went on appeal, decided to create a whole new standard and under which the recycling company does qualify as a joint employer with the staffing agency.
We're talking right now with reporter Lydia DePillis from the Washington Post, talking about a National Labor Relations Board decision last week that looks like it's going to give expanded bargaining rights to subcontracted employees. Now, looking again at the National Labor Relations Board, can you tell us a little bit about who's on the board, their composition, and what they found then?
Yeah, so there are five people on the board, and they are, just like the Supreme Court, appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. And there are currently three Democratic appointees and two Republicans. And this decision was interesting in that it was a party line vote. Three Democrats in favor of articulating a new standard that was more protective of workers, and the two Republicans strongly disagreeing with a very long dissent that took up more space than the opinion itself. And they raised all these potential implications of the new standard, which were hyperbolic, probably, but certainly things that employers are very worried about.
Well, as I understand it, this decision overturned the status quo for quite a lot of years. What does the change signify in terms of the history of this law?
So what the board articulated is in some ways a return to what had been the case in the 60s 60s and 70s until a couple cases in the 80s where the board said, no, employer that's a master contractor or a user, as they call that kind of company, has to really exert very strong control for it to qualify as a joint employer. And so that change in the 80s helped give rise to a lot of really dissociated working relationships where trucking companies, for example, made a lot of their workers independent contractors or contracted with companies to get goods in different places and taxis. So in some ways, the shift away from what the board returned to last week helped the economy transform into the kind of thing that the board said last week was too much of a change. It justified, we said we need to look at the act in a different way now.
So this has been a significant change. What were the arguments that the Democrats on the board made to advance this decision? And tell us a little bit then about what Republicans said in contrast.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, they were looking at, the Democrats, the ways in which the workforce is evolving. And in particular, they focused on the growth of the contingent workforce, and that's people who work for staffing agencies or any kind of subcontracted firm, or even people who work for franchises, which are essentially independent businesses, but that are often controlled effectively by the corporate headquarters, like McDonald's. And they said, look, we need for workers to be able to influence the actual company that's determining their conditions of work. And because if you try to bargain with a company that has no control, it's going to be pretty useless. And now the Republicans didn't dispute that so much as tried to draw out the potential implications of the new standard. And they said it's going to be massively confusing if a worker is trying to bargain with eight different employers at once, because maybe they all have some level of control over their working conditions. And the main worry that employers have raised is that in order to avoid having liability for violations that their subcontractors might perpetrate, they will have to exert a much greater degree of control, which in a franchise context might mean that there's more corporate-owned stores and fewer of those small businesses that franchisees say they are. So that is the main concern we're hearing.
What has the International Franchise Association had to say about this decision?
I mean, they have been yelling at the top of their lungs for a year now, and to whoever will listen, mostly to Congress, but also publicly. And it's sort of a tricky thing to explain, right? Like, why is this a problem? Why does it necessarily lead to franchisors exerting more control rather than less control? It is possible for some general contractors to say, look, we don't want to be classified as a joint employer, so we're going to make sure that we don't influence the working conditions of the staffing agency's employees. And so they could tweak their contracts to make that happen. But the Franchise Association says the opposite will probably be true in a lot of cases, because those master companies need that control in order to make sure their jobs are done to their satisfaction. So they think it will lead to a transformation in the economy in the ways that they really dislike, which could be true.
And what about Congress? Is Congress getting involved in the debate?
Very much. Republicans especially have been extremely concerned about this potential decision, which the board's general counsel telegraphed essentially last year when he filed a brief in the case arguing for a change in the standard. And so they've known about it for a long time. And so Republicans have held hearings, they've sent letters, they have even included a budget rider in the budget, which, you know, won't really be passed because of how Congress works these days, but that would effectively prevent implementation of the new standard at all that would block it. Now, they have a few other options. Certainly, the case will be appealed. They could also try repealing it through the Congressional Review Act, potentially. So there's some other avenues, but they it will take a while for them to sort themselves out, and are not sure bets at all.
Now, as you talked about earlier, this is maybe indicative of the changing workforce. What is the national trend in terms of how many people out there are employed by subcontractors right now?
So it's very difficult, actually, to pin this down. There have been a few studies, but government data collection hasn't really caught up to this trend. So a few things we do know. There are 2.87 million people employed through temporary staffing agencies. There's some work that suggests around 40% of the workforce is contingent in some way, and that encompasses a ton of different types of work, from part-time to temporary, right? So they have varying degrees of protection. But it is something that's been on the rise as more and more companies decide to focus on their core competency and outsource other functions, like cleaning their building or protecting the building with security guards.
And we'll be watching to see what happens next. Lydia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Washington Post reporter Lydia DePillis talking about a National Labor Relations Board decision last week that could give expanded bargaining rights to subcontracted employees.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll ask for your advice and your memories about the first day of school, whether it's college, high school, or kindergarten.
First, we look at the beginning of classes for students in the UW system this week. The summer has been difficult for the state's university system after the legislature cut the university's budget by $250 million over the next 2 years. Lawmakers also included some unexpected changes into law, like a provision that allows campuses to lay off tenured faculty in some instances. Additionally, today is the first of a series of listening sessions hosted by the UW system across the state. The sessions are going to be held this fall to give system leaders ideas for how to be more responsive to the needs of Wisconsin residents.
Karen Herzog has been covering the UW system this summer, and she joins us now. She's higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Karen, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Veronica.
Well, Governor Walker's cuts to the UW budget were national news this summer as part of his home state track record while he's running for president. How are Wisconsin's UW campuses and the upcoming cuts being seen at the national level?
There hasn't been a lot of conversation in the last few weeks about this at the national level. It was obviously very high profile throughout the summer, though, especially conversations about tenure and for potential changes in how tenure is actually going to play out within the UW system. Governor Walker, initially when he proposed his budget in January, indicated that he was looking at the Act 10 of higher education and looking for reforms. And as you may recall, Act 10 for K-12 largely eliminated collective bargaining and some see faculty tenure as a form of job security that perhaps may need to be changed a bit. So the school year is starting up, the new academic year is starting out with a cloud. However, chancellors are working really hard to get faculty to round them up and get them on the right page so that everyone is focused on the students who are now on campus and start classes tomorrow.
Now, over the summer, we saw concern among faculty and others that maybe some of the biggest stars of the UW system, the highest profile researchers, could be vulnerable to poaching from other universities that had maybe better job security, better funding. How likely do you think that that is to happen, or is that already playing out?
It's already starting to play out on some campuses, especially the flagship, UW-Madison. I spoke with a Chancellor, Rebecca Blank, last week, and she said that they've already had some faculty who were offered jobs over the summer, which she said is really unusual because, you know, summertime is typically very quiet on campuses. And she expects it to be a real battle this academic year, but she has said that she will do whatever she needs to keep top faculty, because otherwise what's the point? Now, other campuses aren't as well positioned to with counteroffers as Madison perhaps would be. And I think that there is a lot of concern that some of the junior faculty members, the assistant professors, the ones who are on a tenure track, may look at their futures being perhaps a little bit more stable at another university in another state.
With the budget the way it is, does the UW system have the latitude to make those counteroffers?
To some degree, it's all going to be a matter of chancellors reconfiguring their budgets to make room for some of the counteroffers that they probably are going to have to make. Now, one thing the legislature did do with this new biennial budget is make it possible for chancellors to award merit pay. And interestingly, in the past, there's only been something called competitive market pay. So they couldn't actually award merit pay just because a faculty member was doing a good job. There had to be a threat of losing them to someone else.
We're talking right now with Karen Herzog, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's with us to talk about how the UW system is preparing for the first day of classes after a summer of budget cuts and tenure changes. And Karen, what are leaders in the UW system like UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank and UW System President Ray Cross saying about the beginning of the school year and what their focus is going to be?
They obviously want to set a very positive, optimistic tone. Of course, they acknowledge that it's challenging. I don't think anyone is trying to push that under the carpet, that the days ahead are, and the months and years perhaps are going to be challenging because the cutting to meet the budget for this coming year still isn't completed. There will be more cutbacks announced. I really highly doubt that any tenured faculty would be in a position to be laid off this year because the tenure rules haven't really been established yet, and chancellors have been pretty uniformly saying we're not going to lay off any tenured faculty at this point. We are looking elsewhere. We're looking at programs. We're looking at where we can cut around the edges to meet the budget requirements.
What have we seen so far about how the budget battles over the summer have affected faculty morale?
I think it's safe to say that faculty morale, generally speaking, is very low. Now, that's not to say that faculty aren't professionals. They care a great deal about their students and about their research and their work. So I don't know that students will necessarily see it in the classrooms. But if you talk with faculty, if you kind of listen to what they're telling each other, what they're saying, it's not an optimistic group at this point, and I think there's still a lot of uncertainty, even though the budget was adopted over the summer and they know the total amount that has to come out to meet the limitations of what their new budget is going to look like.
In a recent article, you called UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank defiant and said she won't address her faculty in person until October 5th. First of all, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little more about that characterization of defiant and also what you expect her to say on October 5th.
I think she feels, of course I'm projecting here, but what she has said to me is that she feels very strongly that if the university loses its best and brightest, that it would be damage that would be beyond repair. So she is very aware that there are universities around the country courting her faculty. Now, that's not unusual. That's something that she deals with on an ongoing basis. But she's been at conferences where people have said, hey, we've been reading about or hearing about UW's budget woes and the tenure issues, and boy, you know, we think there'll be some opportunities for us to hire more people. Now, she will address the faculty for the first time at the first Faculty Senate meeting in October. And at that point, she'll have a lot to talk about, especially, I think, the tenure policy, the future of tenure in the UW system and how it will compare. You know, she's very confident that it will compare to peer institutions, that in effect, they won't really see any change in it. Faculty aren't convinced necessarily that that'll be the case, but I guess time will tell.
Now, today is also the first day of listening sessions that are being held across the state. What is the purpose of these?
Well, the purpose of these listening sessions, every once in a while, the UW System Board of Regents develops a strategic plan. And basically, that is the university asking for input on how the UW system can be more responsive to the needs of residents and businesses. So they've scheduled 14 listening sessions across the state over the next couple of months. And this is actually an interesting way that they set it up. They have facilitators. You must RSVP in advance if you want to attend one of these sessions, and they do have them listed on their website. And they're actually going to do this in a format of small groups. They're going to have tables set up where there'll be a facilitator at each table, and people can say, here are my concerns, here are my ideas, and then at the end of each session, they will put everything together, and in the spring, the regents will discuss their new strategic plan.
Now, these have been planned since before the budget battle. Do you expect the tone of these listening sessions to change due to that?
I think that's a pretty good guess that they will be different. Obviously, that's been the talk of the summer, and there are a lot of people concerned about, well, what is this going to mean for either, you know, my child who's a student, or how well the university will be situated to prepare students for the jobs that businesses need to fill. And President Cross has said that it could be said that the future of the UW system would be mirrored by the future of the state, rather, and so that it's the two are tied together so much that it's important that everyone is on the same page.
Do you have a sense of how much the UW system may have changed from the end of last year to the beginning of this fall semester, given everything that's happened over the summer?
That's a really interesting question, and I think it probably depends on who you are, where you're sitting. If you're a student, I really don't know that you'll notice much, other than there are fewer class sections in many cases because there are fewer instructional staff. Instructional staff can be let go if their contracts aren't renewed, so students will see that. The big thing is again, the faculty and the conversations they have amongst themselves and whether they are looking for other jobs. Several people have said, I'm going elsewhere. I'm really concerned about the future of higher education in Wisconsin. Well, others are pretty well established, and they're writing it out, and they're saying, you know, it's going to get better. Our best days are still ahead of us, and we'll just get through this together.
Karen, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Karen Herzog, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us to talk about how the UW system is getting ready for the first day of classes this week after a summer of budget cuts and tenure changes.
Coming up, we'll take your calls about the first day of school. What advice do you have for those who are going off to college, high school, or middle school, maybe even that first day of kindergarten? Are you sending a kid or grandkid off to school for the first time this week? Call in and share your stories, your thoughts, your advice at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll get to your calls in a minute. First, a check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst from WPR News.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and it's back to school time. Today is the first day of school for a lot of students around the state here in Wisconsin, and we want to hear your back to school stories.
Do you have a memory of your first day at a school, or maybe your kid's first day? That memory could be from 30 years ago, or could be from this morning. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 for your first day of school story. And also, what advice do you have for the first day of school for the kids or the parents? Are you sending a kid or grandkid off to college now? What did you tell them to prepare them for the next four-ish years? What are your favorite memories about the first day of school? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Rob, what I've been seeing so far is a lot of Facebook pictures of the kids on that very first day looking freshly scrubbed, a little nervous, and then the caption is usually something like, requisite first day of school picture.
Yeah, it's now a genre of social media. I remember the first day of school for my kids' first day of kindergarten. We, and a lot of parents did this, we put them on the bus. They took a bus to school in those first few years. Got them on the bus, all ran over to our cars, drove over to the school to meet them at the school on the first day of the year. And I believe my wife and I took that first day of school off so we could, just sort of commiserate on the fact that we were now old enough to be parents of kids at their first day of school. So do you have a tradition like that or a story like that to share about a first day of school, yours or your kids at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or get us started on the Central Time Facebook page.
You know, we did that same thing. We had to follow the bus, get there, wait, and, you know, wait for our son to get off the bus. And I remember being, I think, more nervous than he seemed. We were kind of nervous wrecks. But then they showed up, got off the bus, and c'est la vie. They were all good.
Yeah, I think the key to that successful first day of school experience is getting the parents just out of the way as quickly as possible. That happened as I recall, with preschool.
Well, I'm sure it's fascinating listening to you and I reminisce about our children's days, but we want to hear from you. We want to hear from you about your child's first day. Were you nervous when you sent them off to school? Do you get nervous every fall? What about your kid? Is your child nervous too going to school, or are you the one with the nerves? And what do you tell them? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the beginning of the school? Bittersweet or just sweet?
We've got Linda on the line starting us off in Appleton. Linda, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to tell you a little story about my daughter. She's in college now, but her first day of school, I remember my husband and I stayed outside her school for a whole week.
Wait a minute.
Waiting for her. Yeah.
So wait, each day you stayed outside the whole school day, or you like went home
yes.
and then came back at the
no,
end?
No, the whole school day.
Wow.
With our first child. And we loved her so much that that's what we did for a whole week.
And how did she, was she like, okay, guys, I'm good now, you're embarrassing me now, or was she happy about that?
She was in kindergarten, so we stayed outside so we can be out checking her out when she went out for a recess or for snacks. Yeah. Crazy, right?
That is wonderful, Linda. Thank you so much for sharing that story at 800-642-1234. We're asking for your first day of school stories. Maybe it's a story from today. Maybe it's a distant memory. Want to hear about your first day of school or your kid's first day? Yeah, kindergarten, high school, school in a new town, maybe headed off to college. 800-642-1234. We'll pick up next with Daniel in Toma. Daniel, hi there.
How you doing? I don't know. Maybe I'm looking at this wrong, but some parents need to let their kids grow up. Stay outside of school? I mean, you know, I understand you want to be protected. A little bit too much protection.
Now, did you send your kid off to school for a first day?
Yes, I have a daughter. I'm a single dad.
Uh-huh.
My wife passed on, and I raised her, took her to daycare, preschool, watched her every year. My daughter, in fact, when she was, this is a strange story, I took her to the preschool even. I dropped her off on Monday, and I said, well, I'll get you there later. And she goes, no, I'll see you on Friday. She wasn't the only one.
She was ready to be done with you for a while.
I'll just stay right here.
That's brilliant. Daniel, thank you so much for sharing that. So, yeah, some kids are probably more ready than the parents to make that break and get away for a while.
I'm sure just like in college, some kids want to text and call and have the parents hang around. Other kids, you know, they're pretty much leaving skid marks once they get there. It's the last you see them. Zip. Well, let us know what you think. Now, Gustav in Madison said homeschooling kids is one way to go. You can let them sleep in while other kids get up at the crack of dawn. There is that change of the sleep cycle sometimes, having to get up a little bit earlier in the morning. And let's go now to Lois in Wazika. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, what is your story?
Well, my youngest is currently a junior in college, but the year that she started preschool, our oldest daughter also started college. So we are unpacking the college student. My husband later said it was the worst day of his life. But we had forgotten a fan, and it was a day like today. So we came back with an unsuccessful fan search. Finished helping her put a few things away, and they called out that there was a barbecue on the square, and off she went. And we were like, wait a minute. Goodbye, goodbye. And she's like, oh, okay, bye, Mom. And a few days later, I brought the preschooler to school, and she was at a school she was very familiar with, and the teacher took her book bag, she turned and walked away, and I'm like, wait a minute, bye, and she's like, oh, bye, Mom.
Wow, so you had two kids who are just ready to go.
Yep, bye, Mom.
Aw, well, I'm sure it was harder on you than it was on them, sounds like.
Yeah,
when they're ready, it helps you.
That's great. Thank you so much, Lois, for that call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. As we collect first day of school memories, maybe you have a memory to share, or advice, 800-642-1234. We looked online, saw some things on the internet, how to survive the first day of school. And one recommendation there is, treat the first day like any other day at school. So maybe if we, the parents, don't work up to that big scene about it, the kids maybe don't want that, it makes it easier for all parties concerned, as Lois's story, I think, just confirmed there.
I think you can try, but you just are going to be how you are. My daughter started kindergarten this year on Monday, and for all the best intentions in the world of being stoic, you know, you have to show up and be, in my case, a little anxious, a little nervous, a little happy, and that's what it is. And you wait, and you know it's just the first day, and that the year will get, you know, better, the day will be good, and things will change as it goes along.
Definitely. We'll go back to our callers now. John is on the line in La Crosse. John, hi.
Oh, hi. I didn't think I'd get patched through right away. My first day of school, 1959, St. Elizabeth's Kindergarten in Allentown, Pennsylvania. It was in the corner of a gymnasium sectioned off, and my mother worked in the cafeteria, which was attached to the gymnasium, and about halfway through the morning on my very first day of school, they brought me to my mom and had some words, and all of a sudden we were going home, and I was wondering what was going on, and I had come down with chicken pox.
Oh, no.
On the first day, did you feel lucky or unlucky?
I really didn't know what was going on. I was so little at the time, but I'll never forget, I'll never forget being brought in to my mom in the cafeteria.
Oh, that's a memory.
Yeah. John, well, you got better.
I got better.
Well, John, thank you so much for that call at 800-642-1234.
And we're going to go next to Donna in Merrimack. Donna, hi.
Hi. It's just a story that my daughter just sent her son for his first day of kindergarten. And he came home and had a wonderful, wonderful day. And I was just reminiscing about my daughter on her first day. I'm a teacher at the school where she was going to be. She had to get on a bus, and she said, "No, you're not going to take my picture." Well, her father had a zoom lens on his camera, he got a picture of her getting on the bus. And then as she was coming into the school where I taught, I was standing there to get the picture of her in her first day, coming in the door. Needless to say, my second daughter, I was in a different school. You know, first one gets all the pictures, the second one doesn't get much of anything.
Yeah, that can be the truth of it, can't it? But it's nice. Right. Do you still have those pictures?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, we bug the kids. It's the mom and paparazzi, really, with all the pictures being taken. Donna, thank you so much. We've got Teresa in Chautauqua with us now. Teresa, hi.
Hi. I just have a really cool story. My second granddaughter just went to preschool for the first time the other day, and her older sister went with to kind of get her used to it, and she kind of backed away, and her older sister grabbed her hand and said, "It's okay, Briar. It'll be fun." And so she just grabbed her by the hand and took her to some other kids, and it was just really cute.
So I bet it's often easier for the second kids because they've seen big brother or big sister go through it.
Yes, yes. It was very sweet. The mom just started to tear up.
Aw.
So,
Teresa, thank you so much. That's a sweet story.
Thank you for that. And time for another quick call here. Sue joins us in Ashapan. Sue, hi.
Hi there. I actually have similar stories from what you've been hearing, but it was my first child going off to kindergarten, getting on the bus. I've got the pictures. Mm. And even now, it just makes me cry, you know. Mm-hmm. I was just so sad.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that I had a kid old enough to do that. Now her first, she's got a daughter who's starting preschool next week. So now she's going to be going through that.
All these family transitions, you always remember those first days. Well, Sue, thank you so much for that. I appreciate you sharing that memory with us.
Still time for you to share your first day of school story or memory on the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know how it went today. I don't know if you want to share the picture and embarrass your kid with a picture of the getting on the bus or not, but tell the story anyway while you're there.